Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guest this hour has written an absolutely fascinating book he's written several of them. The latest one is The China Mirage, The Hidden History of American Disaster in Asia. James Bradley is our guest. James is a native of Wisconsin, actually. His interest in history began when he read an article by Harry Truman, which encouraged young people to read historical biographies. And James did that. He traveled the world at the age of 21. He went to Japan, Taiwan, Hong Kong, Thailand, Nepal, India, Pakistan, Afghanistan, Iran, Turkey, France, Germany, Italy, England. Graduated with a degree in East Asian history from the University of Wisconsin in Madison. And probably some of this comes from his phenomenal background. His father, who was severely wounded in 1945 in World War II, was one of six men photographed raising the American flag. And James's brother almost died fighting in Vietnam in 1968. James says both men almost died fighting in Asian wars that didn't have to happen. It's a very interesting look at a country that was really closed off from the United States for a long time, and there were a lot of players at work here. There was a China lobby, there was opium, there was a lot of interesting historical figures, the two Roosevelts, Teddy and FDR, who one chose Japan, one chose China to champion, and their advisors, and money coming in from opium trade to build some important things on the East Coast. It's a great story, and James is a terrific historian. Did I tell you he's also author of the national bestsellers The Imperial Cruise, Flyboys, and Flags of Our Fathers, which was made into a movie? And I understand that James has also put together a foundation, a peace foundation, which we will talk about, which is allowing young people to travel to various parts of the world and maybe do things differently than we have done them in the past. Hello, James.
Hello, Kathleen. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. I'm sure that everybody is looking forward to your coming to Milwaukee, too. Where did you grow up in Wisconsin?
I grew up in the big town of Antigo, Wisconsin. It was the maple syrup capital of the world when I was a kid.
The maple syrup capital of the world, and look where you've been since then. You know, let's start with opium, because I must tell you, I didn't know anything about this story. The amount of money that was involved, you know, you could conceivably say that it allowed FDR to be president because he had a lot of money. He was a guy of leisure. His grandfather was really into some shady stuff, and it was a hard thing to do to travel all the way to China to smuggle in opium.
Yeah, a small group of East Coast merchants who... seafaring families wanted to cash in on the number one commodity trade of the 19th century, which was selling opium into China. It was completely illegal, but like all illegal drugs, it was very profitable.
And it was a very, very arduous journey, I'm sure, and he must have been terribly motivated by a certain amount of greed, right? To have the nicest house, a recession hit or a depression hit, and he lost everything and had to go back and do it all over.
Yeah, it was a quick way to make money. You know, if you go downtown Chinatown in New York City, there's only two statues. One is to Confucius, and the other one is to the Chinese official who asked Warren Delano to stop selling opium in China.
Hmm. And a lot of that money, he gave money, was it to Harvard, James, and to some businesses? I mean, he really helped build up the East Coast in some substantial ways.
Yes, the most famous building on the Columbia University campus is Low Library. Mr. Low was an opium dealer with Warren Delano. The tomb, which is the clubhouse of the Skull and Bone Society in Yale, that is underwritten by opium money. America's first manufacturing city, Lowell, Massachusetts, Princeton. Anybody with the name Forbes probably has an opium background.
Really?
Secretary of State John Forbes Kerry, where'd that money come from? Great-grandpa was an opium dealer.
Oh, my gosh. And the British were doing opium as well, right?
Much bigger time, but the Americans were number two. And because the British were there first and did more, We like to tell the history of the opium trade as a British trade, but you know, the Lowe's and the Coolidges and many of Boston's biggest families, the seed money for AT&T, the Council of Foreign Relations, Chiquita Banana. These are all started by opium fortunes.
Hmm. You spend a lot of the book talking about the China lobby and this dream that we had that China would become Christian, it would become Americanized. Was it Warren Delano who really promulgated that? You talk about his carving out New China's enclaves, westernized and Christianized areas like Hong Kong on China's Pacific coast. Was it his hope to really move inward and turn around the whole country?
You know, the assumption, it was more just an assumption that everybody could share that China was like a big old rotted barn collapsing, and the natural thing was that it would become more Americanized and American values would take place. So it was an assumption in the American mind, but it was pumped up by the missionaries who we sent to China. So let's say I'm from Milwaukee and the local parish sends me over to China. Well, I'm writing letters back home, and they're optimistic letters. The Chinese want to become Christian, but, you know, I need some more money for this church wall, and you back in the parish dug in your pocket to support this China mirage. So there was a mirage in the pews of America that China wanted to become Christianized, and millions of dollars flowed to China based on this mirage, but the Chinese didn't want to become Christianized. Nothing was happening on the other end.
Mm-hmm. You talk about, and it was true, particularly for that long stretch when there was absolutely no communication whatsoever, but that there has been, partially because of distance and then partially because of what we created to create more psychological distance, this huge ocean, mind and body of water, preventing Americans and Chinese from really knowing each other, knowing what was going on.
Yeah, in 18, the Chinese were so successful in terms of laboring here that American labor unions wanted them out. And in 1882, Congress complied, and they said, we've looked at the situation, and while you can get democratic values into white brains, you can't get these same values into Chinese brains. Hmm. Therefore, we need to exclude the Chinese from the United States. Up until 1882, there was no concept of illegal immigration. We made it illegal for China to come, China to immigrate, and that went on for 80 years. So in other words, a guy like me from northern Wisconsin, I grew up with Swedes and Germans and Italians and Danes and everybody else, not Chinese. It was illegal for them to come to the country for 80 years.
Mm-hmm. And yet you talk about the two Roosevelts, Teddy, who aligned with one country, FDR, who aligned with the other, who were both being advised by maybe the only two Chinese people in the United States. There were more, of course, but two prominent ones who were their advisors, who were Harvard-educated advisors, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Teddy made friends with a Japanese Harvard buddy who guided him regarding Asia. Theodore Roosevelt had never seen the Pacific Ocean, and we were a Eurocentric country. And then Roosevelt, who felt that he had a special touch with China, developed a relationship with one of the wealthiest men in China, who later got more money out of Roosevelt than Roosevelt spent on making the atom bomb.
Hmm. We certainly welcome phone calls for James, and I should have given you the phone number at the top of the show, so let not a moment go by without my saying it's 1-800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. James Bradley is our guest. He is the author. His most recent book is The China Mirage, The Hidden History of American Disaster in Asia. He is from Wisconsin, got his degree at UW Madison in East Asia History, and has written a couple of bestsellers. He's going to be speaking at Centennial Hall tomorrow evening, and it should be just a really fine lecture. So we certainly welcome your phone calls, 800-486-8655. Could we spend just a few moments, because it would seem to me as though the experience of your father, and he didn't talk very much about the war, and your brother may have formed the thought process of why you would do this particular book. Your father, isn't that amazing, was one of the six men photographed raising the flag at Iwo Jima, but didn't want to talk. So are you doing all of this so you can think of what his experiences may have been, James?
I guess so. You know, I'm a guy whose dad raised the flag on Iwo Jima, and now I'm on my fourth book trying to figure out why he was there in the first place.
Right, right.
And the more I dig, I see that World War II in the Pacific was a preventable war, and that's not some theory of mine. You can see in the book that Franklin Delano Roosevelt had a plan to keep peace in the Pacific. He didn't want a war in the Pacific, but he was stabbed in the back by some China lobbyists in his administration. And we went to what Roosevelt thought was an easily preventable war.
Mm-hmm. So it had to do with an embargo on oil. Tell us that story.
Well, Chiang Kai-shek was the ruler of part of China, and he was promoted as the great Christian who wanted to lead China to Christianity. One problem, the Japanese had invaded. So he founds a China lobby organization in downtown Manhattan. It's staffed by missionaries. It looks like an American organization, but it's supported by Chinese money. And they convince Americans, according to Gallup, 75% of Americans are convinced, hey, just cut Japan's oil, the Japanese military will withdraw from China, and a new China, a Christianized China, will arise. Well, Franklin Delano Roosevelt said, no way, that's not what would happen. If we cut Japan's oil, they only have two gas pumps, California and Indonesia. The Japanese will go down to Indonesia, and that'll involve us in a war. So as you see in the book, to his wife, to his cabinet members, to everybody who would listen, Roosevelt says, if you cut the oil, there'll be war. I can't have a war in the Pacific. I'm trying to help Churchill over with Hitler. I have a Europe-first policy. But Roosevelt goes away in July of 1941, early August 1941, and he goes away secretly. He goes secretly up to Canada to meet with Winston Churchill in what will later be called the Atlantic Conference. When the big cat was away, the mice cut the oil. Roosevelt, from his perspective, thought Japan was still getting oil. The U.S. State Department continued to approve oil sales, but some guys had cut the pipeline without Roosevelt. Mm. I never knew that for 1 month, August of 1941, the President of the United States did not know the oil had been cut to Japan.
He didn't even know. Oh, my goodness.
He didn't even know. He said, if you cut the oil, we'll have war. We can't do that. Well, they cut it, and there was war. So it was a preventable war, according to Roosevelt, and I agree with my president.
Ooh. So do you think that was the main reason for the attack on Pearl Harbor?
Definitely. The Pearl Harbor, you know, we think that's an invasion of the United States. It's not. The Japanese could have taken Hawaii in a second. What they wanted to do was hit the Navy so that the Navy could not interfere with their thrust for oil. What they did that day was, before they hit Pearl Harbor, they were already going south for oil. That was what they had to do. Franklin Delano Roosevelt had predicted it. He said, if you cut their oil, we'll get involved in a war here. And he was right.
Mm-hmm. And so we declared war on Japan, and it wasn't until a few days later that Hitler decided to declare war on us, which is how we entered the European theater, although you must imagine that perhaps we would have entered the European theater somewhat, I don't know, a few months after Pearl Harbor, if Pearl Harbor had not happened. But it would have cut out one theater where millions died of that war, do you think?
Yes, we would have gone to war in Europe, and again, World War II in the Pacific, as you'll see, John Tolan, the famous author in the book, says World War II in the Pacific, totally preventable war.
Mm.
I show the documents and the conversations where Franklin Roosevelt believed that. Mm-hmm. So my dad raised the flag on Iwo Jima, but maybe he didn't have to be out there. And then we continued. But I guess the point here is we got involved. What were we arguing with Japan about? We weren't arguing about tea or silk. We were arguing about China. And it's American misperception about China that has gotten us into World War II in the Pacific, Korea, and Vietnam.
Hmm. And early in the book, you remind us of one of those who served and wrote about it, John F. Kennedy, saying that it was clearly enunciated that the independence of China was the fundamental object of our Far Eastern policy, that this and other statements of our policies on the Far East led directly to the attack on Pearl Harbor, he says, is well known, and it might be said that we almost unknowingly entered into combat with Japan to preserve the independence of China. Kennedy said
right.
that.
But now, and you know, historians just start, and me too, in Flags of Our Fathers and Flyboys, my first two World War II books, I just have Pearl Harbor, kaboom, surprise attack, let's go to war. But in this book, I looked back and you know, wondered, what was the rub between America and Japan? It was over China.
Mm-hmm.
And let's fast forward to Vietnam. We got involved in Vietnam because of the domino theory. Well, the domino theory was not a theory about Vietnam. It was a theory about China. China would take Vietnam and then gobble up all the rest of Asia. Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara, at the end of his life, admitted, gee, the domino theory was never debated at the top levels of government. 58,000 casualties based on a theory, on a mirage of what China would do.
Our phone number is 800-486-8655. The author of The China Mirage, The Hidden History of American Disaster in Asia, James Bradley, is our guest, also author of other books you may have read, Imperial Cruise, Flyboys, and Flags of Our Fathers. He is a son of John Bradley, one of six men photographed raising the American flag on Iwo Jima. And as you heard him say, he is probably writing these books trying to figure out why his father was on Iwo Jima. We're going to go to your phone calls momentarily. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to phone calls now for James Bradley, 800-486-8655. Scott in La Crosse, our first caller. Hello, Scott.
Hi there, Kathleen.
Hi.
I'm enjoying this program as usual very much.
Great.
My question for your guest is about Henry Luce and whether, given, because I grew up in the time when Life magazine, Time magazine, Sports Illustrated were just major players in media. And I guess my question is, does your guest think that the influence of Time at the time had a big impact? Because, I mean, I know that Chiang Kai-shek was on the cover of Time several times, might even been Man of the Year, or Person of the Year, for all I know. Do you think that the Time's impact had a real influence on public opinion?
Boy, the caller's got a good memory for history. Yes, Henry Luce was born in China of missionary parents, and he wanted his father's missionary dream to come true, and he used Time magazine to do that. Chiang Kai-shek, incredible as it might sound, this little tin pot dictator, got on the cover of Time magazine more than Franklin Delano Roosevelt.
Oh my gosh, did he really?
More than Winston Churchill. And Luce called him Southern Methodist Chang, and that he was running a Christian army. You know, Chang was kidnapping his soldiers and chain ganging him into service. Luce translated that as Christianization of his soldiers, and China was going to become Christian if we just supported Chiang Kai-shek. That was the message. And Pearl Buck, the number one author of the 30s, with The Good Earth, she was the daughter of missionaries. She gave speeches at universities about how, you know, on the outside, the Chinese and Americans look different, but because we live in similar continental countries and eat similar foods, our hearts beat just like the Chinese hearts. That's why we love each other so much.
Anything else, Scott?
No, one quick thing I'd just like to say. I really enjoyed your book, Flyboys.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, very, very enjoyable read. Thanks so much. I'm looking forward to reading more of your stuff.
Yeah, you'll like it, Scott. It's really well done. All right, so we're talking about Chiang Kai-shek. Let's talk about Mao for a while and how Mao reached out to the United States and reached out again and reached out again, who obviously takes over here, and Chiang Kai-shek is out. And there's a civil war going on. Did we not have good intelligence to realize what was happening internally in China? And what years are we looking at here, James?
Well, if we look at different sets of years, even before Franklin Roosevelt came to power in 1933, Mao Zedong had already beat Chiang Kai-shek in three massive battles with over 1 million casualties.
Oh, my.
Mao won the first time, second time, third time. Chiang Kai-shek was a loser. None of that information got back to America. It was just Time magazine covers of Chiang Kai-shek holding a Bible. And we are going to have an Americanized China if we just stick with Chiang. Again, you know, no internet, no social media, 1930s, very few people knew China. And this is the point of the book. Our not knowing China has gotten us into trouble. Later, Mao Zedong reaches out to the State Department in 1945, has long, long discussions. He says, I don't want to ally with the Soviet Union. Soviet Union's getting killed by Germany, and they have bad food, borscht. You know, who wants Russia? He said, I want America. I want Washington, Wall Street. He says, look it, we'll take Chinese labor, which we can train, and then American capital and technology. We have a symbiotic relationship. There can be no misunderstanding between China and America. We're the two to team up to make big economies. So Mao is pitching a vision in 1945 that came true today.
Exactly.
But we didn't allow it to become true because of the China mirage. We continued to support the Christian dictator because we thought, you know, the Chinese wanted to become Christian and Americanized.
And what was our vision? Give me more of an idea of what the China lobby wanted. They wanted everybody to be Christian. They wanted American companies there. What did they want?
You know, it started with the Song family. So the Song family is the richest family in China, and they make their first fortune printing Bibles for missionaries. They see that nobody in China wants to become Christian, but they see that the missionaries are coming, so they take advantage of the missionary pipeline by printing Bibles and making a fortune. And the kids go to school at Harvard, Wesleyan, and Wellesley, and they see this missionary pipeline, millions of dollars flowing to China. So they call in Chiang Kai-shek, and the Song family says, okay, we'll ally with you against Mao under four conditions. Number one, you put a Song in as your prime minister, you put a Song in as your treasury secretary, and you marry my little sister, a Song. And then you've got to become Christian, because we need photos to send back to the United States of you reading the Bible, and America will cough up a lot of dough. So it really was a shell game based on this missionary mirage. When we supported Chiang Kai-shek, gave him a lot of money all through the 30s and 40s.
And whatever,
Harry Truman.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. Kathleen.
No.
But I just, see, people might think this is James Bradley coming to conclusions. President Harry Truman said the Songs were all crooks. They were thieves. They stole everything we gave them and invested it in Manhattan real estate and down in Brazil. That's Harry Truman.
And what's happened subsequently to the opium trade, James?
The opium trade meandered around, but Mao wouldn't tolerate opium at all. Hmm. And in 1949, when Mao came to power, people don't realize his first edict was equalization of men and women. Between the sexes. He said women hold up half the sky.
Right.
And then one of his first edicts, another edict, was a no opium, and he cleaned China out. If you want to import some opium into China right now, you get a bullet.
Mm. Let's go to more phone calls. Scott, thank you very much for your call. Daniel in Appleton, hi.
Hey, thank you for taking my call. I've just fascinated the last couple segments here as it came after I called in. James is really fascinating me, and I just happened to tune in on accident and get your number. And what I wanted to ask the guest today was, he had made reference earlier to the opium trade and how it built up the rich families on the East Coast, and he mentioned Skull and Bones. And some time ago, I read a book by Chris Milligan called Fleshing Out Skull and Bones, and in it, he talked a little bit about how in America we didn't talk much about how when Kerry was running against Bush Jr., that they were both bonesmen, and when they were asked on camera on two different major media outlets to discuss what this bonesman crew was, they both kind of like just shied it away as nothing. And then recently he just made the mention of Time Life magazine printing lies to promote personal gain. I was wondering if he might have any comment about John Kerry and Bush Jr. being bonesmen and how our media didn't really dig hard into what might have been a conflict of interest there for the American people.
Yeah. Well, Skull and Bones, you're sworn to secrecy. And Republican or Democrat, they do not talk. It's very interesting what might be going on there. When you see the number of power brokers who have run this country that have come out of a secret kind of weirdo society that is still being funded by the Russell Trust. The Russell family were the employers of Warren Delano. That's opium money. So it's a fascinating can of worms that you bring up there.
Thank you very much for your call, Daniel. We go to Louis next in Wausau. Hi, Louis.
Yes, good afternoon. I read a book by Barbara Tuchman called Stillwell in China, and it was a very smaller time frame than what you're talking about here, but she pretty much confirmed what you're saying, and that Vinegar Joe Stillwell lobbied really hard for the U.S. to dump Chiang and take up with Mao, and he was overwhelmed by the forces you've been talking about. I wonder if you can comment on that.
Well, again, here I am on Wisconsin radio, and the callers are all educated and well-read. That Barbara Tuchman book on Stillwell is just one of the best reads, and I quote her a number of times in my book, The China Mirage. But that is the caller's got his finger on the mirage. The U.S. military was in China sending intelligence back to the United States saying, this Chiang Kai-shek, it's ridiculous. He's kidnapping his soldiers. There's no morale. They're not fighting the Japanese, and he's going to lose. Mao's the future. Mao is effectively fighting the Japanese. We have to team up with Mao. For saying that, Stillwell got fired. Later, some State Department guys came to Roosevelt's Washington and said, Mao's going to be the next emperor, and he has offered to ally with the United States. But Mao, you know, was not sending pictures of himself reading the Bible back to Henry Luce, never made it on the cover of Time magazine, and we fired every American State Department service officer who ever met Mao.
We fired them.
And in the 1950s, there were zero people in the China section of the State Department who could speak Chinese.
Oh, my gosh.
This is the basis of McCarthyism. Our Wisconsin hero, a saint here, Joe McCarthy, his first speech that he rabble-roused into McCarthyism, that where he said, I've got in my hands 223 commies in the State Department. Well, he only named one commie, and that was John Service, the State Department guy who knew Mao best. Hmm. Service spoke four Chinese dialects and had told Washington, Mao is going to take over. For that, he was the first one fired, and then we fired everyone else who dealt with Mao.
So it was all wrapped up in this Red Scare.
Yeah, but the Red Scare was rooted, as you see, in this China mirage.
Yeah.
The point is here, if you look at the history, when Mao rose, Americans said, hey, how'd this happen? Franklin Roosevelt, Pearl Buck, Henry Luce told me that Chiang was going to take over and he's going to build a bunch of churches. Now you got this pagan Mao. Gee, there must have been some traitors in the State Department. Hmm. And Senator Joe jumped on that.
Hmm. So let's go back for a minute. I want to go back to the Japanese in China. How did FDR think that this would all go if we did not embargo the oil? How were the Japanese, how did he believe they were going to leave China, and what role would we play in that without an embargo?
Well, there was two levels of thinking. One was, you know, which I didn't realize, it was very dollar and cents. The State Department and FDR said, look, there's no minerals or resources in China that we can't get anywhere else. So China doesn't matter, number one. Number two, China's too big for the Chinese for the Japanese to eat. You know, they're at some point going to get indigestion. Number three, we don't care about Asia as much as Europe. Roosevelt announced to everyone inside, to the military, I have a Europe first policy. Let's withdraw resources from the Pacific, put it in the Atlantic. I want to fight Hitler, and I don't want war in Asia. And the way to keep peace in Asia is to continue to appease Japan with American oil sales. So that was Roosevelt's strategy. But these genius Washington wise men deep in the administration pulled the rug out from underneath them.
Let's go next. Thank you, Louis, for your call. We go to Peter in Wonder Lake. Hi, Peter.
Hello.
Hi.
I'm calling because I used to work for an outfit called the Flying Tiger Line many years ago. And I was wondering knew and met some of those old guys that flew for Claire Chennault, worked for Chiang Kai-shek and later a flew for the airline that they started after the war.
Hmm.
What do you know about that?
A lot. There's a lot of information in there about Claire Chennault. I thought the Flying Tigers were an American creation. The Claire Chennault was a mercenary who was illegally working for Chiang Kai-shek in the 1930s. He got kicked out of the U.S. military. The U.S. Air Force did not want Claire Chennault around. He went and worked for Chiang Kai-shek. Chiang Kai-shek had this dream that if America would give him 500 airplanes, he could beat Japan. Claire Chennault came to Washington to pitch Chiang Kai-shek's idea, and the War Department wouldn't receive him. The Navy Department wouldn't receive him because he had been booted out of the military. So they went in through the China lobby into Roosevelt's office. And Roosevelt then asked his military to support this idea. The United States military would have nothing to do with it. So Roosevelt created a secret airline that he ran off to the side with advisors outside of the Pentagon. That's the reason that Obama has a drone program. That's the reason that the president of the United States has a private air force on the side.
Oh, we need to know our history, don't we? We need to know our history. What difference does it make? You mentioned this in the book or in something you've written about. But thank you, Peter, very much for the call. What difference does it make that the only Chinese names that we in America could probably easily recognize would be Mao and Chiang Kai-shek? But since then, we'd be hard-pressed to come up with any other leader, either before or after. What does that mean?
It means that we don't know what's going on with the world. And by the way, I'm not criticizing anybody or us. You know, there's nothing wrong with our minds. The point is, for 110 years of our existence, we stopped our relations with China. In the 50s, you know, one reporter got into China in 1957. I was taught that Red China wouldn't let Americans in. It turns out the State Department wouldn't let us go to China.
Mm.
So this reporter evades the State Department, he gets into China, and he writes an article, comes back to the United States, Eisenhower takes his passport away.
Goodness.
Now you've got one-fourth of humanity. You know, my dad taught me how to drive on Highway 45 up there through Antigo, and if that was humanity's highway, and the biggest truck on the highway is Chinese, it's one-fourth of humanity, and if instead of watching how it was going, if I was looking at my cell phone of images of how I wanted that truck to go, I'd get in an accident. I'm not paying attention.
Mm-hmm.
These accidents are called wars. We've had three preventable wars because we didn't understand China. McCarthyism was an outgrowth of misunderstanding China. The China mirage got us into Vietnam. And again, I didn't write the book to help the Chinese. I wrote it to help the United States and Asia. We just have to pay more attention to that big truck on the road.
Jake in Oshkosh, hi.
Kathleen, you had said earlier we need to pay more attention to our history, which is exactly where I want to go. I'm a college graduate, and I've never in my entire educational career have heard anything even closely resembling this history in any history that I've ever studied. And I was wondering from your guests why that is.
You know, people ask me in my last two books if I'm upset about any of this. The thing I'm upset about is that I got an American education and we were not allowed to know these things. The big thing, I think, in the book is that the Washington wise men made so many mistakes and they're able to just stamp top secret on it. I mean, to have the domino theory penetrate from the New York Times down to the Antigo Daily Journal, to have the domino theory stop arguments, in other words, you know, we've got to go into Vietnam because of this domino, and then to have Secretary McNamara say, gee, it was a theory that was never debated. We never talked about it. It was a belief. So this is the point of the China mirage. We have dealt with theories and beliefs about China without knowing it. Stephen Schwarzman, one of the richest guys in the world, he's head of the Blackstone Group in New York, huge wallet. He reaches inside there, takes out $300 million. And he says, what's the number one thing I can do for America? And he's created a scholar program for kids, American kids, to go to China. He thinks if you leave it to Washington and the New York press, you're going to have a war with China based on misunderstanding. We need to build a bridge of understanding. Again, not to help China, but to save us.
And you're doing something similar, too. Can you talk just a little bit about the foundation, the Bradley Peace Foundation that you set up?
Yeah, I'm not one of the richest people in the world. I reached in my pocket and took out some pennies. And for the last 14 years, we've been sending kids to Japan, China, and Vietnam to go to school. The idea here is that because of the Chinese exclusion laws, because from 1949 to 1979 we couldn't deal with China, the bridge between the United States and China is very narrow and rickety. The bridge across the Atlantic to England is very wide and strong, and we're not going to ever go to war against England because we'll work it out. So Stephen Schwarzman has the Schwarzman Scholars. You can look at schwarzmanscholars.org. Send your kids, grandkids to China for free. And let's build a generation that, again, doesn't understand China for China's benefit, but understands China so we can see which way Asia is going to go.
Mm-hmm. Let's go next to, Jake, thank you very much for your call. Let's go to Carl in Milton. Hi, Carl.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi, Carl. Sure.
My comment is that wouldn't the Japanese have gone to war with us one way or another to get us out of...
To get you out of where? Well, Carl, we'll have to fill in the rest of that, but I think we can. James?
The answer is no. We didn't have any military over there. They couldn't even find us to fight. We weren't in Asia. Roosevelt was trying to keep Asia quiet so he could fight in Europe. And look, you know, look how the Japanese did against Mao. Mao, with his brilliant guerrilla tactics, really gave them a hard time. Japan never occupied all of China. It wasn't like they ever conquered China. They couldn't conquer their first goal, which was China. It's too big to eat. So Roosevelt was going to let Japan continue to munch on China. It didn't matter if Japan held China in terms of our need for worldwide resources. We'd fight the war in Europe, and then if we had to do something in Asia, we'd do it in an orderly way. But Pearl Harbor was definitely preventable. This is not my opinion. Look at the book. You'll see that it's the opinion of Franklin Delano Roosevelt.
Hmm. Imagine what it must have been like to have to put together this enormous Pacific War. I mean, all the people, all the military, all the planes and the boats that were needed, and to figure out a strategy, what a task, and to be on a European front as well, but to start with a Pacific front that you had no idea you were going to be involved in.
Exactly. In August of 1941, Roosevelt met with Churchill, and they discussed Iceland and the Mediterranean and the Russian front and France and this and that. And if you look at everything they discussed, it was they didn't talk about Asia at all.
Mm-hmm.
Because Roosevelt told Churchill, there won't be any fight with Japan because I control their oil pump. Mm-hmm. Roosevelt was completely confident we'd never have a war with Japan because the oil would continue to flow. Well, as he was saying those words to Churchill, some geniuses in his administration were cutting the Japanese oil supply, which led to them going to Indonesia, and it led to them having to attack us at Pearl Harbor to reach their goal.
More phone calls in a moment. Our guest this hour is the author of The China Mirage, The Hidden History of American Disaster in Asia. James Bradley is our guest, and James is from Wisconsin. He's a graduate of UW-Madison in East Asia History. He's written several other bestsellers, one of the books made into a movie, Flags of Our Fathers. He's going to be at Centennial Hall. For those of you who are close to Milwaukee, it should be a really interesting evening. It's tomorrow, sponsored by the Friends of the Milwaukee Public Library and Boswell Book Company, and that's tomorrow at 7 o'clock, right? Yeah, 7 o'clock tomorrow, Centennial Hall, the library, which is a beauty of a library, 733 North 8th Street. More phone calls, 800-486-8655 is our number. You can send an email if you'd like as well. That's talk@WPR.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And let's go to more calls. Mary in Madison, hi.
Hello. I was wondering if he could sketch out the Boxer Rebellion, and if that's pertinent to what he's talking about. And also, what does the Boxer Rebellion Day mean in Britain?
What does it mean in Britain?
Yes, I believe that's what she said.
That was the question?
Uh-huh.
The Boxer Rebellion... The West, including the British, French, Americans, came in through Canton, down near Hong Kong. So the Chinese had built the Great Wall to keep the barbarians out of the north, but the sea barbarians came in on their ships from the south. And we sucked out more silver out of China for to pay for opium than China had made in the past 200 years. Inflation whipped the country. Farmers couldn't pay their debts. This really tore at the fabric of Chinese society. And all of a sudden, the emperor was seen as impotent because he couldn't control the Western barbarians and the flow of opium. Just imagine, you've got the most powerful naval fleets, let's say, off the coast of New York, and they're pumping in cocaine into America, and the people who are getting rich are American criminals, and the government can't do anything about this. It was a crisis. A idealistic, very charismatic leader arose. There was the Boxer Rebellion, huge mess, and the West came in and put that down. It was the first time that the United States sent troops overseas without congressional approval. And it was just part of a mess that China was in, and the dynasty fell in 1911, and then you see the rise of the Song family, China's richest family, then taps into this missionary pipeline from the United States.
Hmm. So why is it, James, your father didn't, I mean, this is such a famous photo, the raising of the flag on Iwo Jima. Why did your father not want to talk about it? And I'm sure you must have brought it up with him because you saw the photo.
Well, he had 8 kids and we all bugged him about it, but he just said that he had some pat phrases. The heroes of Iwo Jima are the guys that didn't come back.
Mm.
We were up at Bass Lake. I was about 35. We were having a fish boiled dinner. Must have been 20 people at the table, and my dad was relaxed, and I said, "Hey, Dad, what still bothers you about that photo?" And he said, "Geez, if only there hadn't been a flag on that pole. Betty, can you pass the butter, please?"
Oh, my gosh.
So he just had these one-liners to get out of it. After he died and I did the research, I saw it. Geez, my dad was a corpsman, a medic on Iwo Jima. He was jumping from foxhole to foxhole that were tureens of body fluids and body parts. Mm. When he looked at the flag-raising photo, now that I have done the research, I realized what he must have seen. Three of the guys on the photo died right after that in battle.
Mm.
One of them died with his intestines in his hand.
Oh, my gosh.
Two of the survivors drank themselves to death.
Mm.
This was Iwo Jima, one of the great massacres in the history of all military fighting. 7,000 dead Americans, 22,000 dead Japanese on a tiny little 5-mile-long island.
Yeah.
So we look at the photo and we think of heroism.
Right.
My dad didn't look at the photo. His memories were of a massacre where he lost friends. His best friend was tortured to death underground for 3 days.
Oh, goodness. And your brother went to Vietnam, and he was seriously wounded there.
My brother Steve went into the Marines and went to Vietnam, but he was hardly there. He got on his first helicopter, he stepped out, and guess what? Helicopters are noisy. The Vietnamese knew exactly where we were going to land. And bang, 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 they killed the guy next to Steve, and the bullet went through Steve's chest, near his heart, blew out his back.
Oh, my gosh.
He's on the ground, and the Catholic priest gave him the last rites. But he survived, came back about 100 pounds lighter.
Mm. Mary, thanks very much for your call. Let us go next to Gabriel in Wausau. Hi, Gabriel.
Hi. Yeah, I was just wondering if you could illuminate this topic for me. I know that there's quite a controversy over the Chinese imperial family being issued a bunch of gold bonds to the United States. And then, like, through the evolution of that, I know the Clinton administration had quite a strong connection with Taiwan. And I was just wondering what your view is on, like, the old imperial families and how our view of them affects the overall view of China today.
Well, you got me there. You know, China is a pretty big subject. And as you'll see in this book is mostly about Washington's actions regarding China. Most of the characters are American. It's really about American views of China. And I did not delve into the imperial gold bond situation that you talked about.
We haven't talked about Teddy. Teddy chose Japan. Which one did Teddy choose? Teddy, should we cover his...
Japan.
He chose Japan. We haven't talked about his involvement very much, and that's another whole angle. We got Korea, too, an outgrowth of all of this.
Japan, so let's go back to the 19th century. American opens up Japan. We have a special relationship. And the Japanese do something that no other Asian country did, and that is they industrialized and militarized. They built a military-industrial complex, unlike the Chinese or the Thais or anyone else, and they were our number one customer in Asia. And they propagandized themselves as the Yankees of the Far East. Teddy Roosevelt was enamored of them, and the theory at the time was China was a failing civilization, going to fall like a rotted barn, and that Japan should be the leader of Asia. So Japan's goal was to get to Korea. If you look at a map, Japan is an island nation. The stepping stone onto the Asian continent is Korea. And you'll see in the book that they convinced Theodore Roosevelt to abandon Korea's independence and give it to Japan. We had a treaty to protect Korea, and Roosevelt's Japanese friends convinced them to ignore the treaty.
And that's another story. Well, James, thank you so much for being with us. It's going to be a really interesting night tomorrow, and thanks for writing the book and being with your Wisconsin audience.
You're welcome. It's nice to have my voice at least up there in Cheesehead Land.
And you will be here yourself tomorrow. James Bradley and the book that we're talking about, his latest, it's The China Mirage, The Hidden History of American Disaster in Asia. James, also the author of The Imperial Cruise, Flyboys and Flags of Our Fathers. He'll be at the Centennial Hall Library tomorrow night, sponsored by the Library and Boswell Book Company, 7 o'clock, Centennial Hall, 733 North 8th Street. Thanks to KP Whaley for producing this hour and for on-air production.